Coming today on the show, the headliner is Ernest James Gaines, one of the great writers of any venue, but he happens to be right here in our midst, not far from the studios of WRKF, is Ernest Gaines, who turns 80 years old today, born on this date in 1933, and what a career he's had. And he is back home to talk about then and now. The incomparable Ernest Gaines will be with us. And warming up in the bullpen is the irreverent Bill Maher, the man who hosted Politically Incorrect on ABC and for the last decade has been the host of Real Time on HBO, is coming this way, and we will talk with him about his appearance in Baton Rouge and much more. All this, but first the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're pleased at this time to visit with Bill Maher. For a decade, he has hosted Real Time on HBO, and before that, almost a decade with Politically Incorrect on ABC, comic, commentator, actor, a man about town, and he will be in our town come January 27th at the River Center. Good morning to you, Bill Maher.
Nice intro, very smooth. Thank you.
Well, speaking of smooth, you're pretty smooth. it all started for you as a stand-up comic, didn't it?
Started, and I think at some point we'll end there. I mean, not that I'm not doing it now. I'm doing it, but I have a TV show, too. But at some point, I feel like they put everybody who's in TV out to pasture. I mean, Johnny Carson was pretty much the biggest star in America, and they put him out to pasture at 67. So I don't expect that will go on forever, but I think I could pretty much do stand-up till I'm dead. I mean, George Carlin almost died on stage. George Burns was booked when he was 100. It is the great thing about stand-up comedy is you can do it for a long time.
Even our friend Larry King is doing stand-up comedy.
Can you believe that? And he's funny, too. I've seen Larry.
Yeah, he is. You have stated that Johnny Carson, who you just mentioned, was a big influence on you. And the cadence,
yeah.
the rhythm, the style, much of it comes from Carson.
It's true. In a monologue setting that I do on the show, I can't help but get that out of my blood. I mean, he was somebody I watched every night from maybe the age of 12 to 22. And, you know, he would always say that he got it from Jack Benny, and he was doing Benny. And so I guess I'm doing Benny by third generation. But, of course, when I'm doing stand-up, that's a little more passionate. You know, Johnny's style was a monologue style. And when I go out in the country and do my act, it's not quite that. It's more prowling the stage.
And Johnny stayed largely away from politics. You obviously have not. You embrace it in every way, shape, and form. But I'm sure he had thoughts, but he just didn't convey them on the grand stage that he held.
Well, he certainly didn't stay away from politics. He stayed away from taking a side. But his monologue was all politics, mostly. But it was, you know, the rule book back then was that if you took a side, you would alienate half the audience. I remember when I started Politically Incorrect, that's what they told me. They said, you can't do a show like this because you'll alienate half the audience. And I said, well, let's try it. let's see what happens. You know, maybe the audience will fool you and they'll be okay with that. And that's exactly what happened, was that people who don't agree with you on everything, it was okay.
Yeah.
They didn't melt, you know. They were like, yeah, I don't agree with everything this guy says, but I find him funny, and I think he's honest, and he tells you what he really thinks, and he's not doctrinaire. And I think that has served me well over the years, that every once in a while I say something that disappoints my normally liberal audience, and the reverse, you know, because I've never really been an ideologue. I've become much more on the side of the Democrats. But not because I think the Democrats are the miracle party. It's because the Republican Party has become the mental patient party. You know, when you have people like Todd Akin and economically people believing in trickle-down economics that has been twice disproven in the last 30 years, I don't know how you can be anything else. So I would say, you know, it wasn't me who changed. They changed.
You say in a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, you can't run for president if you don't know how old the world is.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of stuff, right.
Well, there are people running, including most likely our governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, who is ramping up for 2016. And he says he believes that the world is not as old as we think.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know what to say about Mr. Jindal. I remember once discussing on the show the exorcism that he performed in college. He once held a girl down and shoved a Bible in her face for hours, you know, and claiming she was screaming. Yes, because you're holding her down and shoving a Bible in her face. I mean, I don't know what to say about people who believe in exorcism in the year in 2012 and don't think that the Earth is the age that scientists say it is, and believe in the Bible, which I call the old book of Jewish fairy tales. It's an embarrassment to the rest of the world, which embraces science. We are the only country, for example, that doesn't believe global warming is happening. At least half of our politicians don't. They say it's a hoax. Other countries have conservatives and conservative parties. But they don't debate whether global warming exists. They debate how to deal with it. And there's a host of issues like that where our right wing really holds this country back. And at a certain point, I don't know how many elections they have to lose, but they will get the message that America, even America, which is, I would never accuse of being the brightest country on the map, even America is catching up to the fact that we are going to get our ass kicked in the world unless we join the ranks of the modern countries.
How do you explain the president winning re-election? And obviously it's been well reported that you supported him, not only from your perch at Real Time, but financially as well. But he won by almost 5 million votes. And even Nate Silver, I don't think thought it was going to be that big of a rout.
Well, it's partly what I was just saying, that, you know, I think America certainly has come around to the idea that person to lead them needs to be a modern, forward-thinking person. I mean, when they came out with their slogan, forward, it seemed lame to me. But the more the campaign wore on and the more we saw of Mitt Romney, it sort of made sense. Yes, I get it. If you're going to try to capture people's imagination with just one word, if that's all they can remember, that's the word. Let's move forward. Let's not move back into trickle-down economics, which we've already tried and didn't work. Let's not move back into a time when we didn't believe in science and the Scopes trial hadn't happened yet. Let's keep moving America forward. And, you know, I think that's what happened. And I think for Mitt Romney, what appealed to the Republicans about him, because they really didn't like him, was this idea that even though America is changing, here's a guy who stands against change, as William Buckley once said, stands athwart history with their hand up and saying stop. And that's what Mitt Romney represented to them. He looked like a 50s dad. And they all believed in one thing that bound them, which was that life was really quite perfect in 1958, before there were Negroes in the FBI or recycling or, you know, Dora the Explorer or whatever it is that bothers them. They constantly regale against the changing of America. You always hear that phrase, we want our country back. Back from what? As if President Blackenstein has changed America all that much. He's really not that even a liberal president. I laugh when they call him a socialist. Socialist. I wish he was more socialist.
One thing I would disagree with you on, I think Romney and his wife, Ann, they're probably the most telegenic couple to ever be on the national scene running for president and first lady, but it didn't work out for Willard Mitt Romney, who had every hair in place.
Yeah,
and
didn't say they weren't telegenic. No, he definitely looked like the president, and she kind of looked like the first lady. Remember when she got up at the convention and told the story about how when they were starting out in life, they were so poor that they had to use the ironing board as the dining room table? Oh, yes, and they had to eat rats by flashlight, and Mitt had to play piano in a whorehouse just to make ends meet. Oh, it was so sad. Of course, his father was the governor of Michigan at the time.
Well, you come from a somewhat privileged background. You went to Cornell. You got a good education, Bill.
Well, I mean, more privileged than some, but I certainly wasn't born rich. We were quite, I wouldn't say needy, but, yeah, my father was actually out of work at that time. And, I mean, a lot of Cornell was paid for by scholarships and then by selling pot.
Well, have you revealed that elsewhere?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Bill, it was the 70s. We were all doing it.
Well, you were born in 1956. Yes. Birthday this month. You have commented that you will remain single if you have your way for the remainder of your days. Why so?
You know, I'm certainly not against monogamy. I'm certainly not against a lifelong relationship. I just have never understood why you would want to invite the government into your love life. You know, if marriage didn't exist, if no one had invented it, and you came to your friend and said, "Oh my gosh, I met the perfect person. I am so head over heels in love." Would they really say, "That's fantastic. Let's get the government involved"?
Well, I am 2 years younger than you, and I have not married either. And you have commented that your married friends quite often, you believe, are somewhat envious of you. Is that right?
I don't know. It depends on the marriage that they have. I mean, so I know people who have fantastic marriages. I've never been against marriage if it works for you. For some people, this is a fantastic institution. For other people, it's just obviously the divorce rate over 50%. It doesn't work out. And I think what I've seen in my lifetime is just a shifting of attitudes. It used to be that if you didn't get married, you were considered somehow deficient. You know, they used to use the phrase commitment phobic, you know, like it's a disease, you know. Well, I used to say, I'm not commitment phobic if that's just my choice not to commit if I want to be a single person. But, of course, you know, I'm older. Now I am committed. I like that. I mean, that just changes my life. But, again, I just don't understand why the government gets involved. Because once the government gets involved, everything goes to hell.
Well, it is curious that some of the folks who are most sanctimonious about the rites of holy matrimony are most against gay marriage. Marriage is okay for some, but not for others.
Right. Yeah, I mean, these are all the people always screaming about freedom. And yes, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's not the definition of freedom. And certainly gay people should be able to marry. And of course, again, there's another area where America has moved a lot to the left in the last 10 years. I mean, it was only 2004 when George Bush won re-election by putting gay marriage on the ballot in key states, and that got a lot of people coming out to those on the polling place on election day to vote against gay marriage. And while they were in the booth, of course, they pulled the lever for Bungles the Clown. But you couldn't try that trick today because it probably would backfire. It would bring out people voting for gay marriage.
Well, you have followed the American political scene for a few decades now at the highest levels of broadcasting. The 8 years you were on Politically Incorrect, I was an avid viewer, and I saw the night that the party began to unravel. Your statement in retrospect was rather benign. In fact, it was made, you were agreeing with, of all people, Dinesh D'Souza, weren't you?
Right, yes.
What happened?
Well, you know, that's funny. I had Dinesh on this year just a few months ago when his anti-Obama movie came out. And I hadn't seen him since, you know, and I sort of confronted him with that. I said, you know, how come when I get into all this trouble agreeing with you, you didn't stick your head up and say, hey, wait a minute, why are you attacking Bill Maher? He was really just agreeing with me, and I'm a conservative. And it's funny, some of the people who defended me, like Rush Limbaugh, were the conservatives, you know, because, look, people wanted to get rid of me. That's the backstory to this, is that the disc jockey in Houston who started this campaign to get me off the air, he'd been trying to do this for years, and he saw an opportunity here. It was right after 9/11. People were upset. They were witch hunting. They were looking for something. And you know what? He eventually did me a favor because I'm much happier at HBO.
We thank you for joining us, Bill, and January 27th, Bill Maher will be at the River Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bill Maher, who will turn 57 years old in 5 days on the 20th, will be with us in Baton Rouge in 12 days. And coming in about 90 seconds is Ernest Gaines, who's celebrating a birthday today, the fabulous writer, who lives in Oscar, Louisiana, not far from us. We'll be back with the great Ernest James Gaines in a minute and a half. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we're pleased to have our headliner with us, the Honorable Ernest Gaines. Good morning to you, Ernest.
Good morning to you, Jim, and happy birthday to you, too.
Well, happy birthday to you. Born in 1933 on this date, and where were you born?
Right here where I'm sitting now, from Oscar, Louisiana, Pointe-Coupee Parish.
Almost precisely where you're sitting.
Well, I'm on the same plantation. It's about, I think I was born about half a mile from where I'm sitting right now.
And where you are is quite prominent in what you write about. Anyone who has read the words of Ernest Gaines through the years in one memorable novel after another knows that Louisiana, and in particular Pointe-Coupee Parish, those are the backdrops for most of your work.
All of my work. I've been trying to write about other things, about San Francisco, because I spent most of my life in San Francisco. I try to write about my Army experience, bohemian life in San Francisco, all that sort of thing. But nothing came true until, unless I was writing about my little parish here.
Well, you had an amazing life. It's still going. And you left Louisiana when you were 15 years old, right?
I had to leave, Jim. I had no place to go to school. There was no high school here, or junior high school. I didn't have enough people in Baton Rouge or New Orleans. And my folks had gone to California during the war seeking work. So they sent for me. And I got an old brown suitcase from one of my uncles, packed 2 or 3 little pieces of clothes in it, shoes, something to eat. I think the old people gave me some apples and oranges and tea cakes. And I went to the road, the highway, to flag down the bus with my suitcase. My brothers and friends following me. And I stopped. I got on. I walked to the back of the bus. I had to, because there's a little sign that said white and colored. And you just stand behind that sign or sit behind that sign. I found a seat behind the sign. I went to New Orleans. There I don't know how I did it, but I called her. I got to the train station. I asked. I was 15 years old, and I asked somebody, you know, where do the colored people sit on this train? And he sent me toward the first car, because at that time, blacks were sitting in front on trains, because they were closer to the engine. And the blacks and whites were sitting in the other seats. So I got on there, and with my little suitcase and my little food and clothes, and headed toward California. About 50 hours later, I was in a little town called Crockett, California. So I had to get off the train in Crockett, and catch a bus to go to Vallejo. I think a taxi to go to Vallejo. I had never been anywhere in my life before, but I was determined to go, and because my folks wanted me to get educated.
Now, you were the oldest child of how many?
Oldest of 12. Two of my brothers are dead. My Lionel and Eugene are dead. And they're buried back here in the cemetery here on River Lake. and it's about half a mile, three quarters of a mile from here. But my other siblings, well, I have one with a brother here in Louisiana, and my other siblings are sort of spread out different parts, one in Vegas, one in Texas, Chicago, right, and the others are in California.
We're visiting with the great Ernest Gaines, and his work brought him worldwide acclaim, but he was far from an overnight sensation. Your first book was published when you were 31 years old.
Right, that was Catherine Carmier. That's a, you know, excuse me, Jim, I have an awful bad cough.
You're doing a fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I always tell people that two of the most significant days of my life are when I left Louisiana in 48 and when I came back to Louisiana in 63. I left because I had to be educated. I came back because I was trying to write a book and I was having a lot of problems writing it. That same year, in 62, two of my friends were going to Mexico, Guadalajara. But that fall, Jim Meredith enrolled at the Ole Miss. And the hell he went through, I thought, good Lord, here I am trying to write about the South, and I want to stay in California or go to Mexico. So I called them, I wrote them a letter, Jim and Carol, and I told them, I said, listen, I can't join you in Mexico. I have to go back to Louisiana. And, you know, to write. And so I came back and the following, see, Jim Meredith went in 62. I came back January 63 and lived with my uncle and aunt in Baton Rouge. And there I was writing on my first novel, Catherine Carmier. I spent 6 weeks with them. And, well, you know how the South was in 63. And there were demonstrations and all kinds of violence going on. But I needed to know, live through the stuff that we're going to write. And there were some demonstrations, but I was sort of out. I was there, but not in the demonstrations. And I would write in the mornings and go around with my uncle and friends in the afternoon and in the evenings to different places, cafes, bars, went hunting in the woods, with fishing in the river. I'm doing all this sort of thing that I know I needed to write, you know, because I was writing about, only thing I could write about was about this part of the world, my little patch of ground here in Pointe-Coupee Parish is all I knew. So that's what I did. 6 months after I was here in And Louisiana, I went back to San Francisco, and then there I finished writing Catherine Carmier. So I feel that the two most significant days of my times was when I left in 48 to get educated, and when I came back 15 years later to
1963.
To finish my novel. And so that's sort of what happened.
Now, Catherine Carmier was published in 1964, and it is not as...
Wait, 64, that's even I'm sorry. You're right, Jim. You're right.
It's not your best known work, but it is an amazing piece of literature. And how much of your life is on the pages of Catherine Carmier?
Oh, I don't know. Some of my life is in all of my characters. Catherine and what's my hero's name there? Jackson. I forget my characters myself. But I'm in all of them. Jackson is a guy who comes back to the South after 10 years and falls in love with Catherine. Well, I came back to after 15 years, and so that sort of thing, yeah.
Well, you met your wife, Diane, after Catherine Carmier, but are there any similarities?
Well, I don't know. Well, they're pretty much the same color, same Catholics. They are Catholic in religion, and they're both beautiful, and she's from Louisiana, and,
yeah, well, we just talked to Bill Maher. He's about to be 57, never married. It took you a while, didn't it?
Yeah, it took me a while. It took me 60 years.
And then you met Diane.
Well, yeah, I met Diane, but between those 60 years, Jim, I got to be honest with you, between the 20 and 5 and 60, there were several ladies in my life.
Well, you were living in San Francisco in the 60s.
I was living in San Francisco, and that was during the 50s and the 60s, and, San Francisco was a wild place at the time, so...
And you savored every inch of it, didn't you?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Jim. I would have done more if I thought I'd live to be 80 years old.
Well, how was it living in that place at that time? That must have been incredibly stimulating for a writer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I lived in apartments, and you couldn't throw a rock out of the apartment where I lived and not hit a writer or an artist or somebody like that. But I lived through the beat era and the hippie era and the free love era and the Black Panther era and all those eras. And I was there, but my mind was still in Louisiana. Body went to California, and the mind stayed in Louisiana.
Where did you live in San Francisco?
I lived in the Western Division. It was once called the Fillmore District, and on Divisadero Street and Golden Gate Avenue.
I bet you did a lot of walking in those days.
Oh, man, did I walk. Well, I was poor. I didn't have anything. I had to walk. Man, I spent much money on shoe heels and shoe soles. Then I paid on a car, I tell you. I San Francisco, how much hilly it is. And I'd walk and walk and walk. I could walk to the ocean. I lived about 4.5 miles from the ocean. So I'd walk to the ocean on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. When I was out walking to the ocean, I'd walk to the Golden Gate Park, which was about a couple of miles. No, I drive my car. Well, I had a car then. Mm-hmm. And I walked 2-3 miles in Golden Gate Park before I started writing in the morning.
Did you ever walk to Candlestick?
No. I couldn't walk to Candlestick.
I bet you watched some games at Candlestick.
Oh, man, did I watch the game. I wore overcoats, too, in July and August, watching games in that cold place. I don't know why. I do know why. They built that stadium out there. I think the mayor of California at that time, San Francisco at the time, owned that property, and so they built that place, baseball stadium in the coldest place you've ever been. And you know Mark Twain's old saying. You don't remember that?
I do. The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Right. So I used to watch baseball games with the overcoat on, you know.
With the great Willie Mays patrolling center field.
Willie Mays was in center field. We had Juan Marichal, Jim Gaylord Perry pitching, and Willie McCovey on first, Jim Davenport, and we had a bunch of guys out
Jim
there.
Ray Hart.
Jim Ray Hart, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember the fight that Jim Ray Hart, not Jim Ray Hart. It was Roseboro.
John Roseboro and Juan Marichal.
Marichal had, yeah, I remember that fight, yeah, there. Marichal, whenever Roseboro received the, Roseboro's the catcher now, whenever he received the ball from Sandy Koufax, he threw the ball back to Sandy right by Marichal's ear. Each time,
mm-hmm.
right by the ear, I'm ticking in the ear. And Marichal asked him, "Why do you do that to me?" And Roseboro didn't answer him. And he returned the ball back to Sandy Koufax. And Marichal said, "Why do you keep doing that to me?" Roseboro wouldn't answer him. So Marichal flipped the bat. He took the head of the bat, and he tapped Roseboro on the forehead, and then the fight broke out. All the Dodger fans came out to protect Marichal. All the Giants fans went out to protect. All the Dodger fans came out to protect Roseboro. All the Giants fans came out to protect Marichal. So it was a big battle out there.
Yeah. May have cost the Giants the 65 pennant. As great as those teams were, they never won a World Series. It came very close once, as we know. Do you follow the Giants today? They're riding high.
They're my favorite team. Yeah.
What did you think about Barry Bonds not getting in the Hall of Fame?
Jim, I think that's a shame that Barry Clemens, I think. They will get in, I hope. You know, they've always used drugs of some kind, Jim, and then on athletes. You know, even when guys get hurt years ago, and you put some kind of something in their knees or their ankles or their shoulders or something, and send them back out there on the field. We've gone through that, so it just happened that at this particular time that they thought they would strike back at.
We'll return with Ernest Gaines on his 80th birthday in Oscar, Louisiana, and we will take some calls if you'd like to join us. 297-5633. Back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is the number as we round out the hour with Ernest James Gaines, born on this date in 1933 in Oscar, Louisiana, where he is situated as we speak. He is a writer of significance in this state and in this land of ours. And, of course, as he's told his amazing story, he was among the fifth generation of sharecroppers to be born on the plantation where he is in Point Capique Parish, the setting and the premise for many of his works. Beryl in Sherwood, please be brief. Beryl, you're on with Ernest Gaines.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Gaines, and happy birthday.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Gaines, I work for the school district here in Baton Rouge, and I've also worked with your sister here in our district. I work with children with the most significant cognitive disabilities in our district, and I wanted to let you know we wanted to give our students access to great literature. So we worked on adapting one of your books, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, for our students, and it's been used in our classrooms. We also observed copyright law and bought copies of the book for those classrooms. But I just wanted to let you know that our students are being exposed to your wonderful writing, and I wanted to thank you for what you've shared with us and with the world.
Thank you, ma'am. And, you know, that book is being read by French students who are studying English in France. It's required reading by all French students who are studying English in France.
And this Friday at the Manship Theater, the annual Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence will be event. And it's at the Manship Theater, 6 o'clock, doors open. And this year's award winner, Stephanie Powell Watts, will be on our show this Thursday. I know that is something you're quite enthused about and proud of, the fact that this award has become a staple and a significant event each year in this part of the world.
Yes, and I heard recently that it's the most prestigious award for African-Americans, budding writers. We just got that news, I think, last week or week before last. And so we are proud of that, yes.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk with Ernest Gaines, Dorothy on Perkins Road. Hi, Dorothy, you're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Ernest. I, in connection with the last call, my child had to read a lesson before dying for school, and I actually read it with him because he hates to read so much. And I absolutely love the book, and I was curious to know, I know that many of your books are required reading in Louisiana, but how widespread that was. So it's interesting to hear that it's also required reading in France. But how widespread is that? And I grew up across the river from you in West Feliciana Parish. And one of my great uncles, John Griffin, ended up in Poinkapie Parish. And I'm just curious to know, when you wrote about the mulattoes in Poinkapie, whether any Griffins were associated with any part of the writing you picked up on, or your imagination in creating the mulattoes in some of your writing.
I to answer your first part of your question, the book is read and taught and throughout the country, many universities and middle school colleges, and it's taught, it's been translated into about 20-25 foreign languages, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, German, France, and many, many others. And several foreign students, one from Egypt, who wrote a dissertation on my on the book, A Lesson Before Dying. Another one from France wrote hers, a book. And another one from three people, I can't think of it right now. Dominique, and that one there from Egypt. And the guy from China. Yeah. A guy from China wrote his dissertation. He was a scholar, fellow here at LSU a year ago. So, the book is read and translated, all over the world, yes.
And about the motivation for some of your works, people you've encountered, any family in particular?
For the motivation for my work?
Yes.
Well, I think the greatest influence of my work has been my aunt who raised me, Miss Augustine Jefferson, which whom we call Auntie. She's buried back here in the cemetery. She's the greatest influence on me as a man, as well as my writing. She didn't walk a day in her life. She crawled over the floor all her life. She lived to be 50-something, 53, I think. And she used to cook for us children. And she would, you know, it'd bring the thing, everything to the stove. We had this old wood-burning stove, and we'd chop the wood and bring the wood there.
Mm-hmm.
We'd bring the food to her. She sat on a little bench, and she had another little bench in front of her, and she put that, the, you know, we put the stuff on the little bench in front of her, and she would put the stuff in the pot and stir the pot with a long hand spoon. And she'd wash our clothes. We moved that little bench away and put a wash tub there, and with those old washboards, you know, you scrub with those old washboards. She'd wash our clothes on that, and bracing herself on the rim of the tub, and she'd iron our clothes, bring the little bench back. She put it on there and heat the iron on the heat on the stove, and then you know press out clothes like that.
Now, when you're buried, Ernest, will you be in the same place that?
Definitely. I've already picked out Diane. I've already picked out our places.
What will the tombstone read?
My tombstone will read that to lie with those who have no marks. Most of the people buried back there, their graves were not marked. They just dig the hole, put the coffin in a box, and box in the ground, and many of them have, you know, decayed and
mm-hmm.
don't know where they are, who they are. So I wish to lie with those who have no marks.
To lie with those who have no marks.
Right.
I was in California a few weeks ago and near UCLA, where the Westwood Cemetery is, and many Hollywood luminaries are buried there. Jack Lemmon says, Jack Lemmon in. That's it. And Merv Griffin says, I will not be right back after this message. 297-5633. We will take some more calls for Ernest Gaines as we round out the hour on his birthday, number 80. Did you ever think you'd make it this far?
Well, never did. As I said before, I would have had more fun in San Francisco if I knew I was going to live this long.
You're writing as we speak. It's something that stimulates you like nothing else, doesn't it?
I'm only living when I'm writing, Jim. When I have these long periods of not writing, I'm not really living. I'm not alive. But I'm writing now, and I'm very happy with my writing. And I would be over there at the trailer now. I have an office over there now if I were not on the phone with you.
Well, we're honored that you're spending part of your birthday with us.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I hope to see you later.
I'll come by. This has become kind of a tradition, and of course, it's my honor to be in the presence of the great Ernest Gaines. Now, Newsweek described your writing in this way, saying that Gaines' writing is marked by what Ralph Allison describing the blues called near tragic, near comic lyricism. How would you describe your writing?
Well, that's a good description of the writing, but I wrote my latest book was Mozart and Lead Belly, and I, you know, when I studied in California, I studied no black writers. All of my writing, from high school, college, even at Stanford, all the writers I read were white writers. So I learned from reading white writers, studying white writers, how to write the story, how to write the novel. But I learned from my own experience and my African-American experience what to put in to the novel. See, the white writers taught me how to build a house that's represented by Mozart, the title. The black writers, I mean the black experience, represented by Leadbelly, taught me what to put in to the house. So of a house built by the white writers, all everything inside of it is my experience and my people's experience by Leadbelly. And I'm a fan of music from Bach to Coltrane. So all between Bach and Coltrane, I have lots and lots and lots of music. But I chose Mozart and Leadbelly.
You've lived all over the world, but somehow, some way, you found your way back to Louisiana by design. It was inevitable, but I guess the catalyst was the job you got at the University of Louisiana Lafayette.
Right, right. They offered me a job there in 81, just to come as a visiting professor. Then in 83, they asked me to come as a, give me a permanent position there. And I was there for 24 years, I think. And I'm now a writer and resident emeritus.
And the works that we've talked about, written primarily in the 60s and 70s, Catherine Carmier, though, the first one, 1964, published. You actually started that one when you were, what, 17?
Yeah, I did. I was about 16. You know, when I went to California, my stepfather gave me, you know, 16-year-old, I'd like to hang out with my friends on the street, on the corner after school. So my stepfather told me, get away from there and do something else. So I had three choices, Jim. I could go to the movies, I'd go to the YMCA, I'd go to the library. So I went to the, I didn't have any money, so I couldn't go to the movies. I went to the YMCA, and I didn't know how to play pool or basketball. I was a country boy. I didn't know anything like that. And one day, some guy asked me to put on some boxing glove, and I said, oh, okay. And I got in the ring, and that guy beat the living hell out of me. and so, during the second round, I used my teeth, leaning back on the ropes, and took those basketball, those gloves off. And I went to the library from then on because everybody was laughing at me, you know, so. And I just began to read and read and read and read and read and read. Then I tried to write, and I thought I'd written a little novel there. I was about 16, 17. And I sent it to New York, and of course they sent it back, and it was not a novel. And I burned it in the incinerator. And then when I was at Stanford back in 58, I was writing short stories. And you didn't make any money writing short stories if you didn't have a novel out there. So the only novel I could think about was what I tried to write about 10 years before. And that was Kevin Carmier, so I started writing that again at Stanford in 58, 59, yeah.
Let's go to Barry in Mid-City. He'll be our final caller for Ernest Gaines on his birthday. Good morning, Barry.
Well, I just wanted to thank Ernest Gaines for all of his wonderful words and insight and wish you a happy birthday also, Jim.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Barry Weinstein.
God bless you. Wonderful show and many more days for Ernest.
Thank you, Rabbi.
One of the finest gentlemen to migrate to Baton Rouge, and Barry Weinstein came here about 31 years ago, I think, from
Omaha. I met him recently. We had talked a while back.
Well, Ernest, it's been quite an honor to talk with you on your birthday, and we'll have to do this more often than every 5 years, but I'm glad you're writing, and we look forward to reading your words, and thanks for sharing your observations with us about your life and life in general today.
Well, thank you, Jim, and happy birthday to you, man.
Well, I'll see you and the lovely Diane later today, and it is always a honor to spend the day with Ernest Gaines, and we must also note that today would have been the 84th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
Thank you, Ernest. See you soon.
Jim.
Take care. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, same time. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.